Good morning. This is Paula Granquist, and you're tuned in to Art Zany Radio for the Imagination. It is another zany day here on Art Zany Radio. We are getting started this morning. I think I'm going to put in a little music. I know I'm a little nervous about today's interview, and sometimes that happens to me. So the first thing I thought of was I was going to pop in a little bit of The Pines, because they always calm me down. And this is from their album, Above the Prairie, and this is Villisca. I'm not sure if I'm saying that right, but let's take a listen for just a minute as we get set up on Art Zany Radio. And we're waiting for that to click through. Here it comes. I'm not sure why it's not playing. Boy, folks, it has definitely been one of those mornings and weeks this week. It tells me this has never happened before on my little iPhone here. It says not playing. And it's true. It's not playing. So here we go. We got the sound up and we got it plugged in and it is not playing. So, oh boy, folks, this has been one of those days. I went to go and turn on my computer to look up a few things to get ready for the show, and my computer stopped having the internet. It just decided that it didn't want to connect, and it didn't want to be able to use the things with the making it work so I could go and look up some facts. But, you know, we always have a workaround, and that's what we do on Art Zany Radio, and that is, in fact, why it is called Art Zany Radio. So it looks like it's playing when it's here, but it is not. I'm pushing all the buttons, making sure everything is hooked up and hooked in. But we'll go ahead and pass on that and move on. So imagine that this song, it reminded me of Up North. That's why I wanted to pick it. And the Pines do such a beautiful job of sharing with us just sort of that prairie music, the music that makes your heart sing, that reminds you of, you know, why you're here and what's happening. So it's a beautiful song. And I mentioned a little earlier that I am a little bit nervous about today's show. Something happens to me when I speak to authors that I really greatly admire is I get extra nervous. And I'm really not sure why. I've been to hundreds of author events. I've interviewed, you know, dozens and dozens of authors on Art Zany Radio over the, I guess we've been doing this now for 13 years. And it just is, sometimes it's maybe because I just admire their work so much. Maybe it's because I'm not sure what to say. Maybe it's I'm pretty sure I'm going to make a fool out of myself. And here we are already started off the show with a little bit of an oops from the music. And that is just what happens. And that's why we roll with it live. So I am very excited, folks, to be able to share with you today author Sarah Stonich. And she is here to discuss her book, Laurentian Divide. Laurentian Divide shares the story of Hatchet Inlet, and it is Bitter Winters is something that they have that's way up north, and they are set against the Laurentian Divide, but it's the advent of spring that can't thaw the community's collective grief, a lingering since a senseless tragedy the previous fall, weaving in and out of each other's reach, trying hard to do their best, all while wondering what might be. The residents of this remote town, in all their sweetness and sorrow, remind us once more of the inescapable lurches of the heart and unexpected turns of our human comedy. Sarah Stonich is the best-selling author of These Granite Islands, which was my first introduction to Sarah Stonich. It's been translated into 7 languages and shortlisted for France's Grand Prix de I Do Not Speak French. Here we go, another foolish moment. Le Tristesse de Elle, and critically acclaimed novel Ice Chorus, a memoir shelter off the grid in the mostly magnetic north, and her novel in stories, Vacation Land, is the first volume in this northern trilogy, and the second one is Laurentian Divide. She's written novels Fishing with Rayanne, and Reeling under the pen name Ava Finch. She's the founder of WordStalkers.com, and she lives on the Mississippi in Minneapolis. You can visit her website, sarahstonich.com, and she has a book event coming up in Minneapolis tomorrow, Saturday the 15th at 2 p.m. at Majors & Quinn. So if you're out doing some shopping or looking at the beautiful Twin Cities happenings, that would be a great thing for you to stop at. So I'm going to add her to our conversation. Welcome to Art Zany Radio, Sarah.
Hey, Paula, I'm sorry you're having a bad morning so far. I won't make it any worse than saying or anything like that.
It's been a little wild one. I'm not sure what's going on. Yeah. It's like, this isn't happening. And here it is, it's happening. So I appreciate you rolling with that. It doesn't help, but I sometimes get a little nervous because I have admired your work since These Granite Islands first came out. And that was part of, if I'm remembering this correctly, this is one of the things I was going to go look up this morning, the Discover New Writers program at Barnes & Noble. And that was
it was years ago. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. And I love that program. And I think, you know, it really has introduced me to a lot of incredible writing and authors that I've followed. And, you know, they've published many, many books since. What do you remember about that first publication of These Granite Islands and that being a part of the publicity for your first novel?
Oh, I have to tell you, it was so unexpected and such a whirlwind for me. And I was a first time author, and I did a quick tour in France and Italy, and that was quite something. And it was right after 9/11. And so while I was in Europe, a lot of the interviewers, I was the first American they could get their hands on, so they were asking me all about American politics. Yeah, it was a real trip.
What was going on? Was that Barack Obama or what was going
on? No, it was just after 9/11, so it was Bush.
Oh.
And so they wanted, it was interesting to me. A lot of European countries go to their authors to ask them about social change and culture, and they treat them as though they're sort of a barometer of society, which I found fascinating. Not so much here in the U.S. But I was happy to have my opinion listened to, but at the same time, pretty flummoxed.
I would think so. That would not be what I would expect, because I would think people would be asking, so, you know, what is it about, you know, northern Minnesota and, you know, the geography,
right,
and the place,
yeah,
and the setting and,
right,
and grief and loss and all those things in,
yes,
that beautiful book. Your writing just has this incredible magical quality where it just pulls you in, and that's continued throughout all of your writing, and that's why I think it's so fun to be a part of a program like that. I know that it adds a little extra exposure for you, and it, you know, really was how people were first introduced to you. I want to introduce our listeners to you this morning as we talk about Laurentian Divide with that beautiful photograph at the back of the book, because I love your typewriter. And especially on a day like today, when my computer was deciding that Safari no longer wanted to work, it no longer would communicate, wouldn't open, all kinds of error messages. You know, tell me, there must be a story. You're sort of hanging on to it like a briefcase, which I think is pretty, just really looks really awesome. Tell us about it.
I wanted to have fun with an author photograph, and a friend of mine named Shelley Mossman is an internationally known photographer here in the Twin Cities, and she does a lot of high-end fashion shoots.
Ah.
But she also does a very interesting series of real people and artists in their studios, against really interesting backdrops. And I wanted one in the Mississippi River.
Mm.
So I'm actually, for your viewers, I'm standing in the Mississippi River, hanging onto my typewriter and holding pages as though I've just, you know, walked off the bank and are walking in the shallow river in my boots. And it was so much fun to do. And the water is beautiful, and I wanted to do something a little bit different, and my publisher said, sure, go ahead. They let me do it.
Oh, that's, you are now publishing with University of Minnesota Press, who is, I think, just one of the most, the greatest gems in the publishing world, and they have really embraced Minnesota as well as the educational things that they do, but also fiction has really been something they've been building their list, and you've been a part of that. I think that's been extraordinary.
And I've been so lucky to be a part of that. And, you know, a number of years ago when big publishing started to, you know, have a lot of problems, they dropped a lot of mid-list authors or neglected us and places. Some of these university presses really picked up the ball. And the University of Minnesota Press was particularly good about that. And it's so fun to work with them because they'll let me do things like find art for my covers, have my author photo taken while I'm standing in a river, or have my launch party at the Eagles Club with a polka band. So they're so much fun. They're great.
And I think that's, the more local you can be and the more connected to who you want to be, the more authentic you are. I think that's a really important point.
Exactly. And they've picked up my previous titles and reissued them. And they keep more Minnesota titles and more Minnesota authors in print than anyone.
I think
they're amazing. They're just amazing.
I have to agree from my end as far as, being helpful to, help set up interviews and, preview books, that they're just extraordinary. So big shout out to University of Minnesota Press. I want to talk about Northern Minnesota because that certainly is sort of a siren for you, or a calling, a place of you revisit again and again. Tell us about your connections to that part of the world.
It's really like on one day I would say it's my inspiration, and on other days I would say I can't get away from it.
Okay.
Because it is, in a way, it's kind of a love-hate relationship. My family is from there. I spent my summers there, and I spent the rest of the time in Duluth. Now I live in the Twin Cities, but there is something about Northern Minnesota that it's a character in its own right, almost. It's a very different place.
Mm-hmm.
But also a place that other people can relate to. And, going back to my first book being translated to all of these different languages, it shocked me that those people so far away would be interested in this strange little area of Northern Minnesota. But they are. And I think we all have this feeling when we pick up a book, we want to be transported to somewhere else. For that reason, I read a lot of books that happen elsewhere. I probably don't read a lot of books that happen in Northern Minnesota, but I do love to read books that happen in other places. And Minnesotans and Midwesterners certainly appreciate it, because I get mail a lot, and people say, oh yeah, you nailed it, or I know this guy, figuratively, not literally, but figuratively. The person reminds me of my brother-in-law, or yeah, we had that hockey coach. But it is, to me, it is a character, and I treat it much like a character in my writing, I'd say. For sure.
Maybe that's what makes them so successful. I haven't thought of it in that way before, because it really does. I mean, there is and you nail it in your books. You consistently bring us to that. It's hard to put your finger on it, whether it's just the water, the cold, the hardiness, the spirit of the people, the land that talks. I mean, all those things are there. And so it really does shine through. And so being a Minnesotan, it does make me wonder, and it's interesting for me to hear you say that other people are fascinated by it, because it feels, difficult to describe, even though I live here.
Yeah, right. And to me, it's kind of shocking that someone is reading the book in Hebrew,
right.
Sitting somewhere hot and dry. And here we are with our boots on and trying to stay warm.
Exactly. Well, we should talk about Laurentian Divide. And this is something I didn't get a chance to look up, but it is in the opening. I love how you describe this. And is this a true story of how the name came to be of this place and this Laurentian Divide?
Yes.
It is true. Oh, tell our listeners. I think they'd be fascinated to learn a little bit more about the Greek roots, I guess.
Well, I mean, I could actually even read that first paragraph.
Oh, that would be, would be lovely.
Okay. All right. I will do that. And this is in the voice of a pastor, a Finnish pastor who's in his 50s. So you'll have to just imagine that part.
Okay, we will.
And he starts out Sunday morning and he says, "What could Hatchet Inlet here at the edge of the wilderness have in common with 3rd century Rome? You might not know that St. Lawrence River Divide that T-bones, our own Laurentian Divide, is named for a Roman. St. Lawrence was the Archdeacon of Rome, where he held the purse strings as treasurer. A good man when Rome had its share of bad ones, like Emperor Valerian. Think Darth Vader, only not too bright. Kicking Christians out of Rome wasn't enough for Valerian, so he decided to kill them. He sentenced Lawrence to death, but only after he ordered him to turn over the church's treasures. Lawrence stalled, claiming he'd need 3 days to pull the coffers together since they were scattered all over Rome. But on the sly, he was doling out the treasures to the needy, all of it. Then he gathered his entourage, widows, peasants, lunatics, and orphans, and presented them to Valerian as the true treasures of Rome. You can imagine the emperor wasn't amused, and he ordered Lawrence to be roasted on a spit. The story is that when he was half-seared, he said, "Stick a fork in me, I'm done," or something like that. For his trouble, Lawrence was declared patron saint of cooks and comedians.
And I'm sorry, I goofed up again. I said Greek, and I meant Roman.
Yeah, that's all right.
But I had no idea, and that is an actual place and an actual divide up north.
It is, and it's also known as the Hill of Three Waters, because from this point, it was a sacred spot for the Ojibwe, and they had tribal meetings and ritualistic happenings and festivals and things at this spot, which is now in the middle of a piece of mining property, and you can't get to it anymore. But from this point, the water ran in three directions, of course, north to Hudson Bay, south to down to the Mississippi River, and then east to Hudson Bay, or east to the Atlantic. It's this very strange little triumvirate of water sources. And for me, having three major characters in the book, it seemed like the natural kind of stepping off point for these characters to each go on their own journey. And so that was part of why I chose it as well. It was almost too easy of a metaphor.
Yeah, well, I appreciate it because it's something that I, you know, didn't know about and hadn't heard. And it's great to hear you say that, you know, the reason that the three waters and the way that you pick. We should talk about these characters in this book. For those of you just tuning in, this is Art Zany Radio for the Imagination. I'm Paula Granquist. I'm here today with Sarah Stonich, and we're talking about the Laurentian Divide. And this is, I hesitate it's not a sequel. It includes the same characters that were in Vacation Land, but I think they can be read separately. That the stories have the same characters, but it picks up in a new place. Is that
definitely
part of your intention?
I would say they stand alone. The books all stand alone, but yet they are connected. Kind of in the way that Richard Russo's books are connected
by place.
Yeah, by place. So definitely it's the place that's the thread that goes through. They can be read, not necessarily in order. And it's the place. That's definitely the glue. And these characters were taken from the first volume in the series, which is Vacation Land. And there were a few characters in that book that I hadn't really fleshed out very well, or I wasn't ready to let them go when I finished. And sometimes not ready to let them off the hook, especially Pete. So there's three major characters that each tell their story in Minnesota fashion in turn, politely. But that's kind of where the Minnesota nice sort of ends. But they take their turns speaking one after the other, you know, and they go on and tell their version of the story of just 3 or 4 days before a big wedding that's about to happen in Hatchet Inlet, which is the first kind of big happy event that's happened since the fall before, when there was a tragedy, and then this polar vortex winter that everyone just has really slogged through. And this is kind of the light at the end of the tunnel is going to be this wedding.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a little bit of a glitch, of course, because there's a character who's a little slightly based on Dorothy Moulter, for your listeners who know who she is. She was known as the Root Beer Lady. She lived on an island in the Boundary Waters proper. And she was grandfathered in to be able to stay on her property after it was declared roadless wilderness, and then again when it was declared the Boundary Waters canoe area. So she could live there as long as she lived. So this one character in Laurentian Divide has kind of the same deal with the government. And he gets to live in the reserve, is what I call the park. He gets to live in the reserve until he dies. And he hasn't shown up yet after Ice Out.
I love how that
is the mystery.
Exactly. I love how that opened up because I think that it was so relatable, and the fact that these characters are all at this little cafe and they're talking about, you know, they have a pool that they take bets on which day he's going to come back. And he, you know, sort of is really integral to their accepting, I think, of spring and relief of, you know, recognition of the survival that they've just come through. And I think they really, really count on him to represent that for them, I should say. And, it's a great opening because you can just see them all, each one spins their own story.
exactly.
Of what might have happened, what their memories are of him, how they, you know, connect to him. And there's a line in here that I really enjoyed. It is, Alpo is the character, and he's talking about some of his memories. And I love, he says, Rose would say, the key to a person's character is there on their bookshelves, but Alpo has his doubts. How many actually get read, and how many are for a show? Rory is a bookworm, but what kind? Has he been one of those quietly philosophical types all these years? Does he read to escape reality, his past? Has he been out there all this time wrestling with a poet's heart? As Alpo rinses the Tupperware and sets it on the drain board, he realizes how little he knows. I thought that was such a great way to encapsulate these people. He's so central to their town, and yet they kind of like wonder, well, what do I know? What is real?
Right. That is the theme. It's about what we think we know.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the themes that runs through the book, and the assumptions that people make when they don't have answers and facts for themselves. They create them if they don't have them.
Mm-hmm. And that really becomes...
Isn't that the way?
Yeah, exactly. And that becomes really important, I think, in this town when... I mean, there is something... I would imagine none of us who go there on vacation, who go there to visit, who go there to canoe, can know what these people feel or experience by being year-round residents of this place. I think that's what you've really tried to show us it through this book, The Laurentian Divide. And I found these characters so I immediately wanted to just continue. You know, I just fell right into their story. And you do a really brilliant job of, one, reminding us a little of what happened in the first book. So if you didn't read that, you're okay. You get caught up quickly about the events of the last fall. And then immediately we are pulled into their daily dramas. And I wonder how easy that was for you to continue that story.
Well, you know, as I said, I felt like I wasn't really finished with these characters.
Mm.
And also for me, writing about them is one of the reasons that I write, is I want to break that kind of stereotype of what Northern Minnesota is.
Uh-huh.
Because there's definitely a stereotype, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and a lot gets written about the place itself, the beauty of the place, the politics, the industry. So little gets written about the actual people that live there and their lives and how they interact. We hear about the conflict between them, but we don't hear anything about the core of those conflicts and the personal side of those conflicts. Because it is a troubled area sometimes too.
Mm-hmm.
There's oftentimes people are butting heads. The politics can get really vicious. And there is one has something in common with the person who they're opposing. And I want to address what those commonalities are. I don't want to attack what the differences are. I want to look at what the commonalities are and what these people share.
And yeah, that's how we enter this world. And I don't know if this, I hope this is meant as a compliment, because I kept thinking of that great TV series, Northern Exposure. because I loved those characters. And I think, you know, these characters as well just felt like, knowing them felt familiar and yet wonderful and surprising and real. They feel so alive, and I think that's a really great accomplishment for a novel to do that. Like you said, to pull us in and, you know, escape a little bit. Tell us some of your ways of making those people that grounded, that real, that, you know, relatable, of creating an entire, not a sketch, but a real whole human.
Well, I mean, you have to understand that as a writer, I have to live with these people for years. And so I have to make them relatable to me first.
Mm.
And they can't be one-dimensional because no one interesting is. And they have to keep me on my toes. And I have to, but not always in a completely positive way, because that's not what life is like either, and that's not what our relationships are like. They need to be multidimensional. And I know that it's working for me when I'm making a character and working on them. And I kind of step out of the picture and they start acting on their own.
Mm.
So my characters do surprise me, I have to say. Sometimes they do things that I wouldn't have sat down and thought, oh, I'm going to have Alpo do this, or I think I'll have Pete do that. Sometimes just in the writing process, these little moments happen and I sit back and go, whoa. And I'm kind of surprised myself, and then I realize, well, that's them taking off on their own. And I think that's when I'm doing my best writing, is when I get out of the way to let them take the reins, I'd say.
Yeah.
Does that kind of answer the question?
No, I think so. I think it's fascinating to try to explain that to somebody who doesn't write, that's part of what happens is, and the more that happens, I think the more relatable the characters become, because they, you know, you've somehow tapped into that essence that spills onto the page, and that's what we want to relate to. We want to be connected with real people with real problems, and I think you have a storytelling skill that I'm curious about how that developed, of immersing us in the details of life and the ways of these people. What do you think were some of your best training for storytelling?
Well, you know, I don't have any formal educational training in writing other than a couple of classes at the Loft, but I'll tell you, as a kid, I was a weirdo.
Yay!
And, you know, I was the one kind of off in a big family of six kids. I was the one who had her little space under the steps, under the basement steps where I would go and created my own little world and had a lot of imaginary friends and characters that were basically my companions, I'd say, and I lived in that world. I'd have to say that's it. It's being a weird kid probably helps a lot. But just growing up and being an observer of people and being dragged around these little northern Minnesota towns with my dad. You know, we'd go insulator hunting in little towns and walk the railroad tracks, and he'd tell me stories about this old Finnish farmstead, or we'd go to the coffee shop, and just hearing people talk and how they relate to each other. And, you know, I was very shy, and so I would just sit there and listen. So I think it's observation, probably more than anything, and a desire to make characters that would keep me company.
Oh, I think that's such a beautiful thing. I hope all those kids out there who are listening, who or parents of kids who you know aren't like everybody else, just start celebrating that.
Well, I hope they come away with it too, knowing you don't have to go to the Iowa Writers' Workshop to write.
Either,
you know, that's not necessarily the route for everyone, and I don't think it would have worked for me. I think I wouldn't, in fact, a reviewer, I believe, said this once, if I had gone to school, my books wouldn't happen the way that they do.
Ah, that it might. Yeah, that's a strong possibility that because there is something about your voice that's very, like I think I've mentioned a couple times. I mean, it's just really so detailed and lovely, and you know, you just read sentences again and again, and you're like, wow, how did she do that? It's just so. I'm glad nobody took that out of you, and you were able to stay true.
I think that not knowing the rules meant I would not be afraid of breaking them.
Mm.
You know, if that makes any sense.
Sure, because you wanted...
You
wanted to write what entertained you, what you were curious about, and you didn't have any reason to not do it the way you wanted to. And we are all the better for that. Folks, this is Art Zany Radio for the Imagination. I'm Paula Granquist. We're talking with Sarah Stonich. She is telling us about the book Laurentian Divide. And she will be this weekend on Saturday, the 15th of December at 2 o'clock at Majors and Quinn. If you're interested in visiting with her some more, she'll be there for a reading and a signing. It's a great, great bookshop in Minneapolis, right on Hennepin Avenue, if you want to go and visit. I highly recommend it. It's a wonderful place. The names in this book really grabbed me because, like you mentioned, that there's some Finnish roots in them. Pavolas, am I saying that correctly?
Pavola,
okay. That's the name of the kind of the cafe that they all gather at. And I've got to find this spot because this cracked me up. We just had pasties last night.
Oh.
And there's a secret recipe for pasties listed in here. It doesn't quite say exactly how much, but I thought it was interesting. I don't think our family has ever made them with in the dough recipe. There is a cold half dropper of cider vinegar added to the water before you mix it with the flour and beef lard, which is harder. We don't use beef lard either. But I would, would imagine that makes a really great crust.
Yeah, that's what my grandma did, and I've only made pasties maybe two or three times in my life. But again, you know, it's getting my characters to do things that I might not be able to.
Yeah, they can't, right? And I thought it was hilarious that she says no carrots, absolutely no carrots. That's just wrong.
Yeah,
and it's true that every family has kind of a special way of making pasties. I know my husband's family's all from Northern Michigan, and so that's been a big part of my getting to know their family. And so, folks, if you don't know pasties, it's basically a wonderful meat pie with a pie crust, right? Something that sometimes has rutabaga, sometimes butter, onion, potatoes, and meat, and it's delicious.
They are. And originally it was miner's food.
Mm-hmm.
The Welsh brought it. The Welsh miners used to use them. And here's something that I found out fairly recently. A true Welsh pasty has in one corner, it's got the beef and potato filling, and in one corner it has an apple pie filling or a cherry pie filling. So the miners would eat from one side of the pasty to the other. They don't make them like that in northern Minnesota. You know, they've got their own way completely. But this is something I learned in the last 2 years, and I thought that was just amazing.
Yeah,
well, you get dessert after you eat.
I know sometimes my husband family, sorry family, I'm going to tell on you, they will have pasties and then have pie for dessert. And I'm like, I just can't do that much pie crust. But the way that you said to do it, to have a little, you know, a little corner of apple pie filling or cherry pie sounds delicious.
Yeah, doesn't it? I'm going to try it.
I think we both should. Yeah, we'll do the cooking show next time.
Okay, sounds good.
But there is so much to these characters here. Perhaps we should give everybody a little rundown on Sissy, Alpo, and Pete, and some of the other folks it feels like a whole town of people. But Alpo and Sissy are the two that are going to be getting married, and that's the big story. And Alpo used to work in the mines, if I remember.
Alpo was a machinist and then a foreman, and he's been retired, and he's a widow, and has been a widow for about 20 years. Sissy Pavola is about 20-some years as junior. I never really give them ages.
I did notice, yes.
Yeah. And Alpo has mourned his wife for a really long time, and he's coming back into the light, and he's really, really enjoying his retirement. And Sissy is, as I said, younger, and she's still working at the diner, which has belonged to her family for generations. And she's a little bit worried about her mom, who has dementia, and a little worried about the wedding, and a little bit worried about her own future and her own genetics. You know, she's probably on the cusp of getting a 23andMe DNA sample into the mail. And so her mom is one of the peripheral characters. But Alpo's son, Pete, who was in the first version of the first in the series, Vacation Land, he is a troubled man, and he's in his early 40s. He's not much younger than Sissy is herself, and he's in recovery. And this is something that I really enjoy writing about, because it is a really interesting road and journey for a lot of people. And so it's his journey on the eve of his father getting married, and how everybody feels about this wedding and how they've all gotten to this point in their lives. And so there's a little back and forth. We go into their histories some. We go into Pete's difficult history. But everybody's quite hopeful about the future, and this wedding is a big deal for everybody. And there are other characters too that are just sort of the small town characters that you would run into. The cop and the local business owners and the one immigrant who has been, who is a masseur. Who is kind of a stranger to the ways of northern Minnesota, and people find him quite entertaining, but at arm's length. And he's an Eastern European refugee from Sarajevo. And then there's all of the just regular folks.
Yeah.
But the this trio of characters is really this. It's where the story is anchored, are these three people during these 3 days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they're all fascinating, and I love reading about their life up there, and how they represent different parts of being in that world. And it was Alpo who was the last one. No, it was Pete who was probably the last one to see Rory when he went to help him put down his dog. That was a really difficult part to read and to think about, and it does show us, because his memory isn't very clear, because he didn't have a good, he'd been in relapsed, correct?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it's very real, and that part is it's satisfying, and it's also true to who we are as Midwesterners. I guess that's the way I wanted to go with the question, is this town is grieving, and the wedding is one of those first things that they're maybe going to bring a little bit of joy back to town. We Midwesterners can be quite stoic and reserved and private, and I think that's probably also true, maybe even more so up there. So how did you connect with and bring out some of their ways of grieving in the story, with this setup, this place that they live in, the ways that they really don't talk about things?
Yeah, they are a lot all grieving for one thing or another. And that's it for the audience. I'll let them know there was an accident the previous fall in which two young women were killed in a drunken swerve, and that they've spent the winter coming to terms with this, and everybody grieves differently, and they are, collectively there is this cloud over the town that needs to maybe not lift, but at least break apart.
Mm-hmm.
So that there are rays of sun, and anybody who's been through the grieving process knows that it's fits and starts, and it never all happens at once. And so that process I don't know. You know, I mean, I had to look into my own bits of grief and figure that out, and then, you know, talk to other people and see how they recovered and, you know, where they are in their grief. And we lost some family members just in this last year, and they were young people. And so it hit us all really hard, and it was interesting to see how different everyone grieves.
Mm.
And they do all grieve very differently. I think we all find that when we lose someone, when you look around you and, you know, say, here's my aunt, here's my sister, here's my brother, here's the, you know, the guy next door, and we all do things differently.
Yeah, and I think that's what makes it, we don't, maybe don't talk about it as much, which is why I think it's good to read about how characters are managing that, because then that gives you, you know, something to reflect on or think about, well, that's why so-and-so, that, you know, so-and-so behaved that way, or now that makes sense. And I think that, I mean, that's what reading can do for you. But we shouldn't give the impression that it's, you know, it's a wonderfully fun book too.
Right. I was just going to say, you know, I don't want listeners to think this is a sad book.
No.
Because I don't think it is. I think it's very hopeful. And there's a lot of light in it, and that the way that the deaths do get treated is in a very respectful way. But yeah, there's light at the end of the tunnel for sure, because there always is. There's always hope.
Mm-hmm. So that leads me to the question I should ask, because I think I read that there might be a third. Is that true? Is that in process?
Yes, there is a third.
Okay.
So I'm imagining it as a trilogy, and so I've been just doing the research on that, and I've been. Well, I'll let you in on a little secret, and that I probably will go to Finland to do a research trip.
Oh, that sounds fabulous.
Yeah, so I think one of my characters, Alpo Lahti, has a dream of going back to Finland, and there's a lot of history there. And I think that might happen in the next book, we'll see, among many other things that would happen, of course, but... I'm fascinated by the Finnish culture and the people and the history for sure,
mm-hmm.
because some of the conflict that happened there before people immigrated to here, you know, between the Finns and the Swedes, there was this huge bit of history that, you know, was brought with the immigrants when they came here. And so there are still some of these almost residual, genetic backgrounds that these people have, and how those might come out in the next book, we'll see.
We can't wait, but folks should definitely pick up a copy of Laurentian Divide. That is by Sarah Stonich. It is available now, and you can read that separate or start with Vacation Land, which is where these characters are first introduced, do you have a title for the next one, or probably not yet?
You know, I have a working title called Watershed, but, you know, I often change them. So we'll see.
They do change, exactly. And, so that's something we can definitely look forward to. I know I talked at the beginning about getting nervous, and thank you for being so kind this morning and rolling with me, especially as that opening just kind of fell apart right in front of us. Tell me, are there times when you get nervous about writing your stories or doing book events or, you know, talking with publicists or, you know, anything that you do in your writing work?
You know, sometimes I worry that it's not working, of course, as every writer does, and I have my good days and bad days, and if I'm having a bad day, I just do something else. There's plenty of other things to do, as a writer, to go off and write grants or do research or, the 20 other things that goes into making a book. But I don't get nervous as much as I used to as far as public events go. And because early on when my first book came out and some of my events had a lot of people at them, I would get really nervous. And my sister Valerie said to me, you know, they're only coming here because they want to see you and that they want to hear about the book and that they're interested. I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, and I love getting out and talking to people because, I mean, quite frankly, the life of a writer is you're sitting in a room by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's good to get out and talk to people, and it's really great to get out and hear their questions and, you know, see how I'm doing in their eyes. I mean, I get that some with the reviews that people will write. And we really appreciate that, by the way, writers. We love to get our reviews from, you know, Goodreads or Amazon or Shelfari, and those help us sell books. But as a writer, know how I'm doing, because I'll go right away and read all those 3-star reviews because they're usually the most interesting ones. And then if I'm feeling bad about myself, I'll read the 5-star review.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. And, and then maybe if I feel I'm a little too cocky or feel like I'm really doing really well, I'll read a 2-star review.
Oh no. Oh, I've heard though that some writers just do not even approach reviews because they just, you know, don't want to. There's so many untrustworthy reviews about people who maybe haven't even read the book, or especially on some of those websites.
And you can tell those so instantly. I mean, a 1-star review that is going to be. And it's like, well, I'm not going to take that personally because you shouldn't have even written that review. It was just kind of silly.
Yes. Tell me, because I am curious. There seems to be a lot of focus on Midwestern people and culture and, you know, maybe people turning away from the coast so much and saying, hey, what is going on in the middle of our country? And do you find when you do book events, are there differences in audiences as you travel across the country or even within the Midwest?
Yeah, there's definitely, I mean, with my first books, because it was a large publisher, I did a lot more events on both coasts. And I will say that there is a lot of interest in what has been called flyover country.
Yeah.
Especially in Hollywood, there's a lot of interest, very particularly recently, about what's happening here in our arts. Or our literature. I think there's a fascination with this part of the country, and because Minnesota gets, you know, we're always number one this, and Minneapolis, St. Paul is often on these top 10 lists, and the state itself. And I think there is a real interest in this part of the country. Not many people are brave enough, which is to me, because otherwise our quality of life would go way down with the number of people that we would attract. But we have to live through the winters here, and this is our reward is the very place that we live in, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's so true. And do you think you ever could live up there full time? I know you live in Minneapolis now and visit often. Is that something you've considered? I suppose a lot of people ask you that.
No, I don't think I could do it. No, I love Minneapolis.
Right.
And I love Northern Minnesota. I particularly love the North Shore, and I do spend a lot of time.
Do you have a...
I'm also a...
Oh, you're cutting out there, so we missed a little bit of that.
Sorry.
That's okay. You were telling us about the North Shore.
So I go up there a fair bit. I'm also sort of a professional dog sitter. So I go and take people to care of people's dogs in their homes, which is great for a writer because then I can just treat it as a little writing retreat with the bonus of having a dog.
That's a great idea. I had not heard.
It's good. It's good. So I'll go sit in someone else's home and not worry about it other than to leave it nice and keep it running and keep the animals happy and then get some writing done. So that's been something, that's a good way for me to get back to these places in northern Minnesota and also see some different places now that I don't have a cabin of my own, to go spend time in different parts of Minnesota in the north.
Yeah, that's true, because there is a whole lot to be discovered, and you help bring that to us, and I can't think of a better thing to do on a winter day than to, you know, sit down with some characters and hear their story, and you've created another great book in the Laurentian Divide. It's been my honor to have you here today. It's just such a thrill. I hope that we can visit again when the third one comes out.
Oh, I hope so, too. And it was a joy to talk to you, Paula. And you're in Northfield.
We
right?
are, yes.
That's not that far away. And so I'd love to come down, and I'll talk to the bookstore there or the library and see if they'll have me.
Oh, fabulous. I'll see if I can't do something from my end as well. So.
Oh, okay. That'd be awesome.
Thank you, Sarah. I hope you have a great day and wonderful holidays.
Okay. Thank you so much. Thanks, Paula. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Folks, this is Art Zany Radio for the Imagination. I want to thank Sarah Stonich for joining me today, for hanging in there as we had our all kinds of oopses this morning. You know, if you listen to Art Zany Radio, you know sometimes it's just one of those days, and today it definitely has been one of those days. I'm a big fan of Sarah Stonich, and so it was quite a thrill to have her on the show. She is, again, talking about the Laurentian Divide. You can check out her website, Sarah Stonich, stonich.com, to get details about any upcoming events. University of Minnesota Press, UMN Press, is also a great website. They have lots of books about Minnesota, fiction, nonfiction. They have historical, educational, all kinds of things, and they've been really great in supporting me at Art Zany Radio and doing a lot of things for our community. So I want to be sure and pass that on as well. And Sarah will be at Majors & Quinn on Saturday the 15th at 2 p.m. That's in Hennepin Avenue. And you can visit her there or look for future events. Maybe we'll have her here in Northfield. This is Art Zany Radio for the Imagination. There's a lot going on. I hope you take some time to enjoy some of these things that happen only in the next few weeks as we get closer towards the end of the year, and that you always find a good book to take you away for a little bit and find some characters that you want to hang around with. And as always, I hope that you add some time in your week to add Art Zany. I thank you so much for listening. Please enjoy your imagination.